for hiking. We're about to head down a steep slope. "Careful on those stones," I say. "They can be slippery." I want to take her hand and guide her, but with her eyes open, she doesn't need me to, and I'm not sure if she wants me to. "When I was about 12,
"Yeah?"
"I tried to run away," Zoe says. I pick up my pace so I can hear her better. "My parents were so consumed with Connor, like 24/7. I had this plan to sneak into the park with my sleeping bag and stay out here until they came and found me."
Ranger Gus says there are homeless people who sleep in the park and decamp by the time the rangers make their morning sweeps. The rangers only know this because of what the people leave behind.
"I packed a full bag of supplies," Zoe says. "You know that movie Moonrise Kingdom? It was like that, except I didn't pack a record player."
She stops at a fork in the trail.
"Anyway, I never actually did it," Zoe says. "I came outside to the edge of the park, and it was so dark in here I chickened out and went home. I slept under my bed, thinking my mom might come to wake me up in the morning and not know where I was, but she never even noticed."
I can't imagine what it must have been like to have to share a house with Connor. Like having a tornado for a roommate. It was hard enough for people who shared a classroom or bus or hallway with him. I guess living with that chaos every single day could make the woods seem pretty comfy.
I steer us left before Zoe has a chance to choose a direction. The path to the right leads to Cloverfield and the oak tree. "Hey," she says, "you know how I was telling you about that open mic night I did at Capitol? Well, I might be doing another one next weekend."
"You might be?"
"Yeah, I might be."
"Well, I might want to be there."
"I might like that." A bird whips past us and ascends to the open air. That's me up there, soaring. I've never been this high. We hear a chirp, but it's from Zoe's phone. "My mom," she says. "She wants me to ask if you have any more emails for her. Sorry, I know she's annoying."
"Oh, no, that's okay. Does she want them, like, now?"
"Not now, now. Whenever you can."
"Right. Whenever I can. To the ground I fall. I can never stay aloft too long. Not when there's an ugly and heavy truth always dragging me back down."
Chapter 18. Today I'm passing by the zone in the cafeteria, and I hear my name. I'm not sure who dubbed it the zone, but it's the row of tables near the middle of the room where all the notable people in school sit. If an 18-wheeler happened to drop from the sky and land on this one spot, the entire upper crust of the school would be wiped out in one fell swoop. I do happen to know, after reading Macbeth last year, where the phrase "one fell swoop" comes from. Sitting front and center in the zone is the new powerhouse couple known as Roxanna. Roxanna is composed of Rox and his new girlfriend, Annabelle. Poor Kristen Caballero has been banished to one of the outer tables. It's just natural selection, I suppose. As I pass Roxanna, Rox nods and says, "Hey, Hanson." Annabelle looks me in the eye, which she's never done before in the 3 years we've been in school together. All I do is stare back at them in dumbfounded silence. I'm still getting used to how this whole not-invisible thing works. A lot has changed since I made that speech. I've finally escaped the indifference of meh. I am now exclusively eh. I am Evan Hansen. I make it through the zone and proceed to Jared's table. He's chomping on a calculator-sized and shaped hash brown. I squat down next to his chair. "We need more emails," I say. "Can you meet me after school?"
"Not today," Jared says. "I have a dentist appointment."
"Okay, how about tomorrow?"
"Maybe."
I don't have time to screw around. As a budding capitalist, Jared knows that it's a fatal problem when you don't have enough supply to meet demand.
"Unless you just want to show me how to do it," I say. "I've watched you enough. I bet I could figure it out."
"Oh, really?" Jared scoffs. "You think so? Well, be my guest, brother." A wicked joy materializes on his face. "And don't forget to add the offset for GMT, or else all the time zone conversions are going to totally freak out."
"Maybe not, then."
"Well, can you meet me tomorrow, or what?"
Jared straightens his posture.
"Sir, yes, sir. Reporting at 1700 GMT minus 4.
"I don't know what you're saying. Jared rolls his eyes. 5 o'clock. Let's make it 4, actually. I have plans at night. I leave Jared as he's savoring his last bite of hash brown and finally arrive at my new home base, Zoe's table. It's an eclectic mix of people here. A few musicians from jazz band, a kid from the golf team, which I wasn't even aware our school had. A mildly, sort of half-committed goth girl. The backup goalie for the girls' soccer team. Miss Bortle was permanently replaced as varsity coach and gym teacher. Apparently she'd been caught on video savagely ridiculing, by name, a number of generously proportioned students. And finally, Zoe's friend B, who as far as I can tell is her closest friend. I'm not positive about that, though, and I get the feeling that B isn't always sure either where she and Zoe stand. I've learned that Zoe's opaqueness isn't only directed at me. B is the first one to acknowledge my arrival. Are you dressing up, Evan? I check my clothing. I'm pretty sure, unless I'm missing something, that I'm dressed the way I'm always dressed. For Halloween, B clarifies. Oh, right. I forgot that Halloween is coming up. I haven't decided yet. I never dress up. I don't have a reason to. I'm too old to trick-or-treat, and the school has a strict no-costume policy. Zoe leans over. We should come up with something together. A famous pair. Bonnie and Clyde. Mario and Princess Peach. I look down at her plate. French fries and ketchup. She smiles. I wonder which one of us would be the ketchup and where we'd go in our costumes and what it means when she refers to us as a pair. It doesn't matter what we dress as. We could be anything. Sun butter and jelly. Netflix and chill. American Gothic. Whatever it is, for once, I'm in. The following afternoon, Jared and I are at Workout Heaven. As soon as we sat down, Jared tore into a candy bar and now he's really taking his time with it, as if purposely tempting the miserable, sweating bastards around us. How about this? Jared says. Dear Evan Hansen, they tried to make me go to rehab and I said, no, no, no. That's a song, I say. A great song. Change it. Dear Evan Hansen, I don't want to go back to rehab. I don't mind the yoga, and the group meetings are all right, but people share some scary shit, like about sucking dick for meth.
Jared!
It happens! I saw it on TV.
Take it out!
Dear Evan Hansen, I have to find a way to kick this. I don't want to end up back in rehab. It's just no fun.
That's fine, I say. New paragraph.
What's with your arm? Jared says.
I just got my cast taken off.
I see that, genius. I mean, why do you keep squeezing it like that? It's creeping me out.
I look down. It's true. My right arm is clutching my left.
I don't know. Whatever, can we just keep going?
We fight our way to the end of one email and generate a response wherein I'm being the best friend everyone expects me to be. Positive, supportive, generous. It's a role I'm committed to. When Connor needs a purpose, I give him one. When he's teetering, I straighten him out. When he's ragging on his family, I remind him that they love him and they're only trying to help. We crank out 10 emails. We're in such a flow that I almost don't catch one of Jared's inspired inventions.
Dear Evan Hansen, you know that insanely cool guy from school, Jared Kleiman? What am I saying? You obviously know who Jared Kleiman is. Everybody does. What do you think about inviting him into our awesome friendship and making this thing a trio?
No, Jared, obviously not.
Why? What's the problem? You weren't friends with him. That's not part of the story.
Well, maybe it's time to expand the story, Jared says. It's getting kind of stale, don't you think?
No, I don't think that. Not at all. I was his only friend. You know that. You can't just make things up.
Jared removes his glasses and cleans them with his shirt, letting his pale stomach wave hello to all of the gym's patrons.
You're totally right, Evan. I mean, what was I thinking? Just making things up in a completely fabricated email exchange that never happened.
It's like dealing with a child. Just please don't change the story, okay?
He returns his glasses businesslike to his face. Well, if you want me to redo this email, you're going to have to wait until next week because I'm busy the rest of the week and this weekend I'm hanging out with my camp friends, or as I like to call them, my real friends.
Actually, I say, scrolling up the screen, I think we're good on emails for now. Let's call it a day. We pack up our things and zigzag through the obstacle course of workout machinery. On our way to the exit, Jared urges me to look over at one of the moms running on a treadmill. I refuse, but he won't let up.
Seriously, Jared says, I think she's waving at us.
He's not lying. The woman is calling us over to her treadmill. Against my better judgment, I follow Jared over to the woman. She lowers the speed on the treadmill so she can breathe enough to get the words out.
You're the guy from the video, she says. The Connor Project guy. Evan, right?
I nod.
I knew I recognized you. I love your speech. So much. So do my kids.
It's crazy how many people the Connor Project has reached. I get emails and messages from people every day from all around the world telling me how their lives have been affected by this thing we've built. We started a movement, touched a collective nerve, and now I'm seeing it in the flesh, beaming on this woman's face. I thank her and we finally leave Workout Heaven.
Dude, you're a hit with the MILF crowd.
Stop.
Just saying. Honestly, though, I should be getting some of that screen time, too. It's only fair. How about I do a few man-on-the-street videos for the Orchard campaign? I got a dope new camera for my birthday.
I think Alana and I have the fundraising thing covered. I'll let you know if I think of anything, though, definitely.
Got it, Jared says, looking down at the sidewalk. Hey, I bet Zoe's happy that your cast is gone.
I guess.
I mean, talk about killing the mood, right? Having to see your brother's name written on your boyfriend's arm all the time?
I'm not her boyfriend. I don't know what we are. I mean, I've wondered about what we are, obviously, constantly. But right now, all I have are just wild guesses.
Don't even worry about it, bro, Jared says, removing his car key from his pocket. The only thing you should be worrying about right now is building that orchard for Connor. Because if there was one thing about Connor, the guy loved trees. Or wait, you love trees. That's weird. Isn't that weird?
By now I'm used to Jared's blunt humor, but this latest jab feels more brutal than normal, and that feeling only gets validated as he hurries off to his car without me. I guess he won't be giving me a ride home. I walk away from Workout Heaven and toward the bus stop, trying not to think about what Jared said and how he said it, but failing miserably. In no time at all, that ugly heaviness returns, spreading through my body, making it difficult to drag my legs along the sidewalk. And then, in this spiraling state, I feel a sudden chill. The sensation of being followed. I whip my head around and check behind me, but all I find is the empty night.
6. I've been watching him. I can't help it. What started as curiosity is something else now. In some crazy way, it almost feels like Evan and I really were friends. I've heard it said so much, I'm starting to actually believe it. Who knows? Maybe in some alternate universe we could have been. Not that I have much experience in this area. I basically spent my whole life alone. Until I met Miguel. That was his name. Sometimes M. Never Mike. I keep wanting to see him, but I stop myself. What's the point of putting myself through that again? We met sophomore year at Hanover, an all-boys school. I thought I'd hate that, but it actually made my life simpler. I'd rate my experience with girls somewhere between very unsatisfactory and not applicable. It was the fresh start I needed. In public school, I could never escape the vision everyone had of me. At Hanover, I was new again, untainted. No one made me believe that more than Miguel. My first week, we got paired together in biology. I muttered a joke that made him laugh. How do you tell the sex of a chromosome? Pull down its genes. It felt normal, our interaction. What I always imagined normal would be. He knew a little about everything. Spoke about subjects I'd never considered. Cryptocurrency and alkaline foods. Quoted people I'd never heard of. Nietzsche and David Sedaris. Listened to artists I'd missed. Perfume genius in the war on drugs. Asked questions I didn't know to ask. Did the government demolish Building 7 on 9/11? Will humans survive ocean acidification? Where are all the baby pigeons? He could sort out the exact right dosage of edibles to get you floating as opposed to sinking. He told me I was innocent, which was the opposite of how I viewed myself, but something I felt was true in my heart. He saw me before I saw me. He was the first person I'd known who was openly and proudly gay. I was something in between, fluid, the way I thought about both girls and guys. Back then, I had only begun to put those thoughts into action. We hung out a little at school, but after school, we were a duo. We'd go downtown, stay warm in the bookstore, watch the skateboarders at Irwin Center. I'd be waiting outside the bakery when he got off work. I'd go with him to bring the unsold baguettes to his cousin. We'd end up on a bench, tossing bread to birds, regretting how much waste there was in the world. Sometimes these conversations happened on a bus, other nights on his living room couch. His mom would come home and whip us up a feast. I'd leave at bedtime, my belly and head full. Heart too. And then one day in second semester, he was in a panic. They found weed on him. For the first time, his swagger was missing. I tried to downplay it. It's just a little weed. And so what if they do kick you out? You'd be lucky to get out of this place. You think it was easy for me to get in here? Maybe for you. I started thinking the worst. What if he did get kicked out? Where would that leave me? What would I do without him? And then another split-second decision. I went to the dean, told him it was mine. I don't know what I thought would happen. I wasn't thinking it through, just following some gut thing. We all signed the same school contract, zero tolerance. Penalty? Expulsion. My parents tried to fight it, but it was no use. Miguel's record stayed clean, and I got sent to rehab. My father had threatened to send me the year before. My mother persuaded him to send me to a summer wilderness program instead, and then to Hanover. What's crazy? I was basically just smoking weed at the time. But it didn't matter. My track record didn't support my story. I had run out of chances. The irony? It was rehab that introduced me to a new set of bad habits. Wilderness camp was a literal walk in the park compared with rehab. The kids I was with were hard addicts. Some of them didn't even resemble kids. Weathered skin, teeth, eyes. Almost not human, more like zombies. And that's how the staff treated them. Treated us. But I didn't belong there. I acted like I did. Pretended I was a bigger user than I ever really was. Just to blend in. Survival. But inside, I was shaking. I missed home. For once, I had something at home to miss. After rehab, we saw each other less. Different schools. He had a full schedule with work and Amnesty International. Also, his mom didn't want him hanging out with me. I never met his dad and doubt that he ever knew I existed. But we still texted a lot. I'd complain to him about public school, how I was being treated. People hear you went to rehab, and they act like you're poison. You start to believe it, too. Fuck 'em, Miguel would say. Simple and resolute. Fuck 'em. It helped. Whenever I stopped to think about my life, the turn it took, the anger would consume me. I wonder now, what would have happened if I stayed at Hanover? Maybe life could have gone a different way. And then one day, this past spring, Miguel came over. He made a big deal of it, too. I feel like maybe I'm the first Mexican in your house who wasn't getting paid to be here. I said no. What I didn't tell him, he was the first anyone in my house. The first person I'd ever invited over. I'd hooked up with people by then. But it's not like I was bringing anyone home to meet the parents. The house was empty. We hung in my bedroom. He made fun of one of my books. The Little Prince? Really? That actually explains a lot. He said I was a boy in man's clothing. He introduced me to a ton of books and authors. I never returned his copy of The Mysteries of Pittsburgh. There was a new energy between us. We were older now, more experienced. Thoughts had become actions. We got high and lay on the floor. "Your hair is getting long," he said. I wanted to find scissors immediately, but then he said, "I like it." He played me this one song. When it was over, I asked him to play it again. One line stood out. "Don't hold back. I want to break free." I listened to that song every day for months until it became too painful to hear. Lying there, I noticed a birthmark on his neck. I had never noticed it before. I reached out and touched my finger to it. We locked eyes. That birthmark. A magic button. Once pushed, the whole world suddenly lit up.
Chapter 19. Keeping up with fans has become part of my new daily routine. Fans is an obnoxious word, I know, but honestly, I'm not sure what else to call them. Followers is also weird. Across all platforms, I've got at least 100 new followers since I last checked. I guess they're just fellow lonely people who have found hope in our little community, the one I happen to be the face of. What I do know for sure is that these people all seem to have a desperate desire to connect with someone. They feel inspired to share their incredibly personal stories. When they couldn't live up to the expectations, when they borrowed money they couldn't repay, when they feared they'd never leave that foster home, when they lost a child, when they cheated on the only one who stood by them, when the job they needed went to someone else, when the person in power abused his privilege, when the purpose that drove them no longer seemed worth it, when they struggled to get out of bed or go outside or show up for work, when they didn't know where to aim their rage or how to endure their isolation or reverse their mistakes or not give up. I recognize almost all of it, and yet it's so much bigger than me. And when these people write me, they don't just want to talk. They want to listen, too. They're interested in hearing what I think about things. At first, they wanted to know more about Connor, but now they also want to know about me and my life, and not just the big, dramatic stuff, but also the mundane things, like what hair product I use and where I shop for clothes. I don't tell them that my mother takes care of both of those things. Many people keep asking the same question. How come you never post any pictures of yourself? I've always been camera shy. From what I can tell, Connor was the same way. There aren't many pictures of him out there either. Surprisingly, Vivian Meyer took hundreds of photos of herself. It's surprising because she was such a private person. She'd use aliases all around town, and she'd never share information about her past. She seemed to enjoy being anonymous, and yet she took tons of selfies, long before selfies were a thing. If someone as shy and awkward as Vivian Meyer could take a selfie, I should be able to take one too. I smooth down my hair in the mirror, then sit on the bed and hold out my phone. I snap a few pictures and review the shots. I look like someone who's preparing to commit a sex crime. I reset and try again. This time, I stand in front of the window and catch some natural light. I realize that my messy, unmade bed shows in the background, but my smile isn't egregious. I crop out the bed and make it a close-up. After messing around with some filters, I summon the strength to share it with the world. I put away my phone and open my laptop. I should finish my homework before delivering the new emails to the Murphys. But first, I click over to my uploaded photo and see if there's been a response. My photo already has a dozen hearts. I refresh my screen and the number of hearts jumps even higher. Someone already posted a comment. "So hot, sunglass smiley face." Even though I'm completely alone, I blush and kind of laugh gasp. "What are you looking at?" "It's my mom, of course." "Nothing," I say, quickly closing my laptop. "Nothing? You were just sitting there with a huge smile on your face." "I was?" "I don't think so." I slide my computer into my bag next to the printed out emails. "I feel like every time I come into your room, you shut your computer," she says.
I don't know what you do on there that you don't want me to see. I zip my bag shut. I was doing homework, Mom. Do you have a minute? Standing there in the doorway, she resembles a prison guard blocking escape. Actually, I was about to go to Jared's. I thought you already saw him this afternoon. I was supposed to, but he canceled, so we're meeting tonight. We have this Spanish project we have to finish. I have one sneaker on, but I can't find the other. We'll probably be going pretty late, so don't worry about waiting up. He'll drive me home. You can't wait 5 minutes, she says. I pretend to consider it. I really shouldn't. I saw the strangest thing on Facebook today. Oh, really? Do you see my sneaker over there? It was a video from something called the Connor Project. Have you heard of that? I freeze. I knew this moment was destined to come, and yet I somehow convinced myself that it never actually would. She's not finished reporting what she's learned. It says on their website that you're the president. Co-president. I watched the video, she says. Her and every other mother in town, apparently. It was you doing a speech about that boy, Connor Murphy. How you climbed a tree together. I'm done climbing. I don't have the energy for it anymore. I sit down on the bed. You told me you didn't know him, that boy. I know, but then in your speech, you said he was your best friend. She comes close and bends down to see my face. Evan, look at me. I can't run anymore. I've only got one shoe on. What's going on? She pleads. I test it out, what it feels like to let it all go. I tell her, it wasn't true. What wasn't true? She says. I'm so tired of walking this tightrope. Sometimes it just requires too much. I've been longing for the safety of solid ground. I could end it. Right here and now. But then where will I be? Everything else will end too. Everything I have with the Murphys will be gone. My mom will make me tell the truth. They'll hate me. They won't understand what I was trying to do, that I was only trying to help. No, that's not what I want. When I said I didn't know him, I answer, finally. She presses her palm to her forehead, massaging her brain, trying to understand. So you broke your arm with Connor Murphy at an orchard? I nod. It's the first thing Jared ever taught me. You told me you broke your arm at work, she says. At the park. I stand up. Who do you think drove me to the hospital? Who do you think waited with me in the emergency room for 3 hours? You were in class, remember? You didn't answer your phone. You told me your boss took you to the hospital. Well, I say, shrugging, so I lied, obviously. When were you planning on telling me any of this? Or you weren't? When would I tell you exactly? When are you even here? I'm here right now. One night a week? I resume the sneaker search. Most parents try a little harder than that, just so you know. Isn't that lucky for them? Where the hell is my shoe? I have to go to Jared's. I'm not sure I want you going out right now, actually. I'm down on all fours, checking under the bed. Sure enough, that's where I find it, hiding behind the curtain of my blanket. I also spot the plastic shopping bag that contains my cast. I didn't know where else to put it, so I shoved it down here. I never thought I'd have to see it, or think about it. I stand up and slip my sneaker on, after that my backpack. I told Jared I'd be there 10 minutes ago. All right, listen, I'm missing class tonight so I can be here to talk to you, Evan. I would like you to please talk to me. Okay, well, am I supposed to just drop everything because it's convenient for you? I can't just not do my homework because you decided to miss class. In the most deliberate manner possible, she inhales and exhales, trying to remain calm. I don't understand what is going on with you. Nothing is going on with me. You're standing up in front of the school and giving speeches? You're president of a group? I don't know who that person is. You're making a big deal out of something that isn't a big deal. Evan! She grabs my shoulders, forcing me to see her. What is going on with you? You need to talk to me. You need to communicate with me. Nothing is going on with me. I told you, I am your mother! It shocks us both. She never yells at me. I'm your mother, she repeats, quieter, her lip trembling. I look down, unable to endure the hurt in her eyes. There's plenty of it already in the sound of her struggling to catch her breath. and then, lowering onto the bed, shrinking, she says, "I'm sorry." "No, I'm the one who's sorry. It's me." "I'm happy for you," she says, eyes watery. "I'm happy you had a friend, sweetheart. I'm so sorry he's gone." "My friend." I shoved our one real moment together into a plastic bag and hid it under my bed. "I wish I had known him." She wipes away a tear, and then she notices something. "Is your arm hurting?" I realize I'm clutching it again, and I let go. "No. Listen to me. If you ever want to talk, I mean, about anything." I wish I could. I wish I had. But that chance has passed. There's no way out now but forward. Forward right now means getting out of this house. "I should go," I say, my voice hollow. "Oh," she moves away from the door. "Okay." She picks up a pill bottle on my dresser. "You okay on refills?" "Actually, I'm not taking them anymore. I haven't needed them." She studies my face. "Really? So, no anxiety? Even with everything that's happened?" I shake my head. "I've been fine," I tell her. And it's true. Now she's the one shrugging. Neither of us has the answers. "All right, then. That's great to hear. I'm proud of you." It's the perfect time to leave now, while she's got a buoy of good news to float on. But I don't get out fast enough. "I guess those letters to yourself must have really helped, huh?" I can't think of anything more painfully untrue. Eh. She's the one who insisted I be Evan. The name I was born with didn't meet with her approval. 17 years later, and she's still trying to tweak me just a little bit more to her liking. "I have to go," I say, stepping around her. I half expect her to follow me, but when I turn back to check, she hasn't moved. She's looking at me as if I'm a stranger. I guess maybe I am. Chapter 20. The Murphy's garage is bigger than the entire bottom floor of my house. It's cleaner and more organized, too. In my experience, garages are where people store all the junk they don't want inside their home. But Larry Murphy seems like the sort of guy who doesn't tolerate junk. He just throws it away. Zoe's father asked me to join him in here while the ladies cleared the dinner table. I usually help Cynthia, but tonight we're just two guys talking shop. The fight with my mom is only a shadow now. Larry doesn't want to interrogate me. He wants to help me. He's showing me the contents of a plastic storage bin that he pulled off a high shelf. "Brooks Robinson," Larry says, "Jim Palmer." I don't recognize these people as baseball players until he shows me their cards sheathed in protective plastic. "Look at this," Larry says, probing deeper into his bin. "Here's the entire 96 team. "Wow," I say, because I assume I'm supposed to. "You get the right people to come to an auction, baseball fans? I bet you could raise $1,000 for the orchard. Easy." "It's a great idea. I'm definitely going to talk to Alana about it." Larry didn't have much to say about our idea to rebuild the orchard when we first presented it. Cynthia was all in, but Larry just sat there quietly. Maybe that's his style. For all I know, that's the style of all dads. He pulls out a baseball glove from the bin and sets it aside. I swear I have a Cal Ripken in here somewhere. "This is really generous of you," I say, "to donate all this stuff." The door to the house opens and Zoe appears. "Mom says that your show is on and she doesn't want to DVR it again."
"Well, tell her we're busy."
"Dad, are you torturing him?"
"What?"
"Evan, is he torturing you?" Zoe says. "You can tell him he's being boring and you want to leave. He won't be upset."
"He can leave whenever he wants," Larry says.
"Evan, do you want to leave?"
In the first moments alone with Larry, I was praying Zoe would come rescue me. He and I have never really had a conversation, just the two of us, but I'm actually having a good time talking to him.
"No, really," I say. "It's cool."
"Fine," Zoe says.
"Don't say I didn't warn you.
And, Dad, don't let Evan take any more selfies for his groupies."
"I don't know what any of that means," Larry says.
"Ask Evan. He knows."
Zoe smirks at me before shutting the door. Larry looks to me for guidance. I shrug, trying not to let the fact that Zoe just exhibited what I'm pretty sure was jealousy cause me to unleash an embarrassing fist pump. He's quiet a moment. Then he says, "So, you and Zoe?" My face turns what I can only assume is the reddest red a face can turn. He keeps looking at me, not unkindly. "This glove is really cool." I pick up a baseball mitt. "Pretty nice, right?" Larry says, seeming just as happy to have switched topics. "You can have it if you want." "Oh, no. I couldn't." "Why not? It's never been used. I probably bought it for a birthday or something." Only now does it sink in whose baseball glove this is. To hand it back wouldn't look right. Wouldn't feel right either. A birthday gift. Connor will never get another one. Even worse, the gifts he did get are being given away. "My dad and I, we used to throw the ball around in the backyard every Sunday afternoon," Larry says. "I thought Connor and I could do that. He used to complain that I was never around. I was working all the time, so I said, 'All right, let's set aside Sunday afternoons for just the two of us.' And then, all of a sudden, he wasn't interested anymore." He laughs softly. Nothing with Connor was ever easy. He slides his hands into his pockets. "Take it," he says, like he's offering me nothing more than a breath mint. "It's just gonna sit here, collecting dust." I guess I have no choice. "You'll have to break it in, though, first," Larry says. "You can't catch anything with it that stiff." "Great. The gift comes with responsibility, too."
"How do you break it in?"
"Your dad never taught you how to break in a glove?" I don't answer. I don't have to. "Well, there's really only one right way to do it," Larry says, reaching into the bin. "You have to use shaving cream." I figure it's a joke, but then he pulls out an actual can of shaving cream and starts to shake it. "Here," he says, "it's full." Now I've got a baseball glove in one hand and a can of shaving cream in the other. I don't play baseball or shave. "What you do is rub that in for about 5 minutes, then you tie it all up with rubber bands, put it under your mattress, and sleep on it. The next day, you repeat the same thing. You do that for at least a week."
"A week? Really?"
"Every day. Consistent. There are no shortcuts." Larry even has a bag of rubber bands. "Nowadays, with your generation, I hate to say it, but it's all about instant gratification. Who wants to take the time to read a book when you can read the Facebook instead? But there's no substitute for doing the work. None. It just takes a little patience."
He sprays the shaving cream onto the glove and begins to work it in.
"I didn't let Connor take shortcuts. Cynthia was the one with the second chances and the try harder next time. And I was the one who said no. I said, 'Connor, you keep taking shortcuts, you're gonna lose the trail eventually. Pretty soon you're going to end up somewhere you don't want to be with no idea how to find your way home.'"
There's a slight crack in his voice. He clears his throat, composing himself, and stares down into his bin. It's all emptied out. We're not talking about sports or girls anymore. "Connor was lucky," I hear myself saying, "to have a dad who cared so much." Larry arranges the items on the table.
"Well, your dad must feel pretty lucky to have a son like you."
"Yeah," I say. "He does." Here I am, lying about things that don't even require lying. Larry smiles.
"Well, if you want to go catch up with Zoe."
"Right, yeah."
I head for the door, my hands full. Glove, shaving cream.
But something stops me. I turn back. "I don't know why I said that. About my dad. It's not true. My parents got divorced when I was 7. My dad moved to Colorado. He and my stepmom have a new family now. So that's sort of his priority." Larry studies me. Instant regret sets in. I'm not sure why I revealed all that. It's just he was open and true with me, vulnerable, and I wanted to be the same way back to him. It seemed right and fair, and now... He puts a hand on my shoulder.
"Don't forget the rubber bands," he says, dropping the bag into my hands.
I nod, breathing out. "Thanks.
You're good to go."
The light is still on in my mom's bedroom when Zoe pulls up to my house, but by the time I make it up the stairs, there's no longer a glow underneath her door. The note I find in my bedroom reads, "Te amo, hijo mío." I'm baffled until I remember that I told her I was with Jared working on a Spanish project. I picture for a moment my mother having to Google how to write what she wanted to say. It's past 11. She was clearly waiting up for me. I told her not to, but I guess she couldn't help herself. Cynthia suggested I spend the night at their house. "Zoe drives you to school anyway," Cynthia said. "Call your mother and let her know. You can take Connor's bed." It was a kind offer, but too much. I couldn't sleep in Connor's bed. As numb as I've become, I've still got a little sensitivity left. Actually, scratch that. To call what I'm feeling numb isn't accurate. If anything, I'm feeling more now than ever. And not just because I stopped taking my medication. For the first time, I'm actually experiencing life. I finally know what it means to kiss someone. Like, really kiss. For many seconds at a stretch. That happens all the time now. It's basically commonplace, although never boring. And tonight, I learned to break in a baseball glove. Something my own dad never bothered to teach me. Zoe says I should send my dad a link to the speech, but I don't think he'd care about any of it. The Connor Project, the orchard. When he wrote one time on Facebook that he was having trouble keeping the shape of his new cowboy hat, I sent him an article that contained time-tested care instructions. He never responded. I used to mail him postcards, hoping we'd become pen pals, but the one time I received a response, it was in Teresa's handwriting. He enjoys hiking, so I suggested we walk the Appalachian Trail together. He seemed to like the idea, but when I reminded him about it this summer, he came up with an excuse about how he's already flying east for my graduation in the spring, and now with the baby coming, he can't afford to come twice. So what do I do next? I research a trail close to where he lives in Colorado, and I pin all my hopes on that. Pun very much intended. I walk over to my map. I'm tired of putting myself out there. For what? How long am I supposed to wait? 1,800 miles between him and me. Maybe it's just too far. Pretty soon he'll have another kid, a baby pressed in his arms. You can't get any closer than that. How can I compete? Why do I even want to after all he's put me through? I just thought on this one specific occasion not too long ago, I really thought he'd be proud, that he might appreciate the fact that I brought back to life that faded welcome sign outside Ellison Park, a place he used to love to visit, often with me by his side, the two of us together, the memories we had. I just thought that my accomplishment, the gesture of it, would reach him somehow, would connect. But then, of course, like always, that day when I told him, when I sent him that photo, it doesn't matter. I'm done. I remove the pin and toss it in a cup. While I'm up, I fit my new baseball glove onto my hand. I use my free arm, the one that's no longer broken, the one I'm still learning how to live with, to throw a punch at the stiff leather. I punch again, a little harder this time. And then again, harder, and again, until my fist shines the most satisfying red. Chapter 21. The waitress asks if I'd like a refill, but I think I've had enough coffee for one day. If my foot drums against the floor any harder, the owners of Capital Cafe might try to tack on building damages to my bill. I don't normally consume caffeine. Dr. Sherman told me to avoid it. But it was either a coffee beverage or complimentary water, and Zoe said it would be better for her if I spent money while I'm here. I can't afford dinner, so yeah, pass the cream and sugar. She's currently on stage tuning her guitar. It's not technically a stage. It's just a section in the back with a microphone and two speakers. I'm more nervous than Zoe, and she's the one about to perform. I just want tonight to go well for her. The place is pretty empty. There's an old couple eating dinner, another performer waiting in the wings, and a few people with laptops occupying stools. But it's still early. Her voice booms. "Hello!" And everyone looks up. She pulls back from the mic. "Yikes. Sorry." Someone kills the soft music that's playing in the background. The stage, or whatever it is all Zoe's. She strikes a single chord, testing out the sound. I hold my knee still, concerned that my pounding will interfere with her set. Zoe takes a deep breath, shuts her eyes, and begins.
It's a different style than I'm used to from her. Normally, her guitar accompanies dozens of other instruments to form a lush sound. Here, it's thin and bare, just a soft and modest jangle. And then she opens her mouth, and my apprehension gives way to awe. She's not slick or even graceful. She's almost having a conversation with us, more than singing notes. It's rough and vulnerable and genuine. It's everything she is, but less guarded. As I loosen in my chair, so does Zoe on stage. The timidity I sensed in her at the start retreats. Her voice becomes more musical, slipping into a higher, silkier tone on the bridge and going full out for the final chorus. I think it's a cover, what she's playing. I've heard the song before, but not like this. She's made it her own. When she finishes, I slap my hands together. She peeks up, and now that she's stopped playing, she's shy again. I don't care that I'm the only one clapping. The old couple smiles, showing their appreciation. The rest of the room is oblivious. Zoe doesn't seem to notice or care. She's doing her thing up there. This is even better than seeing her perform in jazz band. Way better. The next song is also a cover. My pocket vibrates. In between songs, I check to see who texted me. It's Alana, but I don't have time to read her message. Zoe's introducing another song. This next one I wrote, she announces. It's brand new, and I'm probably gonna screw it up, but whatever. It's called Only Us. Again, I'm tense. It's like watching her dangle from some great height without a harness or safety net below. I remember the way I felt walking onto that stage to make my speech in front of the whole school. The memory speeds up my heart. I try to bat away the negative feelings. There's no intimidating crowd here. Zoe has this under control. She begins with delicate strumming. The pattern she's building feels familiar but also new. It sounds hopeful, her song. I like it already. I like it even more when I hear the lyrics. By the time she reaches the last refrain, I almost know the words by heart.
What if it's us? What if it's us and only us? And what came before won't count anymore or matter. Can we try that? What if it's you? And what if it's me? And what if that's all that we needed to be? And the rest of the world falls away. What do you say?
My ears are untrained, but I detect nothing unsound or unwanted. She's flawless. So, when does your mom get off work? Zoe says as we're walking up my driveway. The last time Zoe was standing on my doorstep, I was trying to get her to leave before my mother could spot her. Tonight, thankfully, I don't have to worry about that. She has class Sunday nights, I say. She won't be home for another few hours.
So we have the whole house to ourselves?
It's not fair that Zoe can just say things like that and send me into momentary paralysis. I didn't think I could be more entranced by her, and then I heard her sing. For the next 3 hours, I confirm, inserting the key into the door. We should throw a kegger. I laugh. We should definitely throw a kegger, for sure. Until your mom comes home. In 3 hours. It's possible I've forgotten how to use words. Thank you for, you know, coming over. I've been asking to come to your house for weeks, and every time you've immediately said no. I know. I wanted to say no this time, too, but I can't keep her away forever. Which is why I appreciate that you're here now. We step inside, and a downpour of shame befalls me. I tried to tidy up as much as I could, but there was only so much I could do. I can't run out and get a new couch that doesn't have faded fabric. I can't paint over the water spots in the ceiling or rub out stains in the carpet. And there isn't enough space in our closets to hide away all the clutter. I didn't even notice half of what was wrong with my house until I started spending so much time at Zoe's. Welcome, I say, trying to rush her upstairs to my room. Not in a pervy way. I would just feel more comfortable in my room. Too late. She lingers in the hallway, pondering a photograph. Is this you as a baby? That fat guy there? Yeah, that's me. Don't say that. You're adorable. Well, fine. If she's going to compliment me, I guess we can linger downstairs for a few seconds longer. The photograph she's currently admiring was taken in our old house. I don't remember much about it, except what I've seen in photo albums. Is this your dad holding you? Zoe asks. No, my Uncle Ben. Photographs of Mark are never to be displayed in the Heidi Hansen household. They belong in boxes and albums only. I remember that the backyard of the old house connected to the woods, sort of like Zoe's house. I have a memory of my dad shooting arrows into a tree, but I'm not sure whether that really happened or I made it up. I start climbing the stairs, giving Zoe no choice but to follow. My phone vibrates again, reminding me that I still haven't checked Alana's message from before. Upstairs, I see a note from my mom stuck to my door. I try to take it down covertly, but Zoe catches it. My mom and I do a lot of message writing, I explain. Pen and paper, Zoe says. Old school. Oh no, we do texts and emails too. Pretty much anything but talking face to face. Face to face, Zoe says. Who would ever want to do that? Not me. Not your face. And I appreciate that, she says, earning a smile from me and reminding me why I love, I mean, excessively like her. Are you ready to see the place where absolutely no magic happens? I say. I cannot wait. I open yet another door for her. The image she is now seeing of my bedroom is fake news. My bed is made, my closet and dresser drawers are closed, my desk is organized, my pill bottles are tucked away in a sock. The manufactured aroma of air freshener permeates. But not everything is perfect. I didn't want her to think I was a maniac, so after cleaning diligently, I arranged a few things out of place. I hung a shirt over my chair, piled some papers on my dresser, and left my most cerebral book out on the night table. While Zoe is surveying my room, I read my mom's note. Eat, please, it says. It's rather curt for her. I guess she's still mad about the other night. Honestly, I don't feel great about it either. I can totally see why no magic happens here, Zoe says, sitting down on my bed. Seriously? No, she slides over and touches the bed. But how do you sleep with this lump in your mattress? I knew I forgot something. I ask her to hop off the bed so I can reach under the mattress. I pull out the plastic bag with the shaving cream slathered baseball glove inside. You're actually listening to my dad? Zoe says. Do you even like baseball? Every answer is precarious. No, not really. I figured I'd break in the glove just in case. Maybe the Connor Project will organize a charity baseball game someday. I'm also doing it so I can tell Mr. Murphy that I did it. I like him, and I want to give him something I think will make him happy. Zoe scans the pile of papers on my desk. What are all these? Oh, those are just... My mom is obsessed with these college scholarship essay contests she found online. She keeps printing out more of them. She lifts the pile off the dresser. There are so many. I didn't pay close enough attention to which papers I left out on my dresser. I know. I mean, I'd have to win probably 100 of them to actually pay for college, when you add it all up. Tuition, housing, books. I still haven't gotten around to starting those essays. I know my mom is trying to help us both, but college is tomorrow's problem, and it's tough enough trying to solve today's. And it's not like I'd win any of these anyway. So your parents, they can't... She doesn't have to finish her sentence. Not really. I'm sorry. And now I'm the sorry one, because she looks sad. I don't want to make her sad. Oh, I meant to tell you earlier, we had a Connor Project meeting a few days ago, and Alana came up with a really great strategy for raising more money for the orchard. Alana is truly destined to run a company, or, like, the world someday. What I'm saying isn't working. I've somehow made Zoe's sad face sadder. For now, I guess we'll just start with the orchard. She sighs and looks to the floor. Can we talk? Oh, shit. I finally did it. I blew the only good thing in my pitiful life. What? She asks, suddenly alarmed. No, just... You're breaking up with me, right? That's why you came over today. Breaking up with you? Not that we're dating. I wasn't trying to be presumptuous. I don't know what this is, if we're dating officially or if it's more like... Never mind. Why am I even still talking right now? It's fine. Don't worry. You can tell me. I'm not gonna cry or start breaking things. She stares at me and I feel my hands start doing their thing. I preemptively wipe them. A useless tactic. I'm great at those.
I'm not breaking up with you,
she says. I pause, making sure I heard her correctly.
Really?
Okay.
Thank you.
Don't mention it, she laughs. Wait, does that mean that Zoe and I are dating? Because, you know, I sort of felt like we were, but I wasn't sure she felt the same way. When do people discuss that sort of thing? Or does it go unspoken until you both just know? Also, how do you know that you both just know?
It's just the Connor Project, Zoe says. I mean, it's great. What you've accomplished is just beyond. Seriously.
There's a but coming.
But maybe we don't have to talk about my brother all the time. Maybe we can talk about other things.
Oh, yeah, of course. I just thought maybe you'd want to know what's going on with everything.
No, I know you did, and I really do appreciate what you're doing.
She sits down on the now lump-free bed.
But my whole life, everything has always been about Connor. And right now, I just need something for me. If this is going to be a...
She pauses and I nearly fall over into the space of it.
Relationship,
she finally says.
I don't want it to be about my brother, or the orchard, or the emails.
I've stopped breathing.
Breathe, Evan, breathe. I just want you,
she says.
Really?
She sighs, frustrated with me.
Did you hear the new song I sang tonight?
Of course, I say. It was amazing.
Did you hear the lyrics?
You and me, that's all that we need it to be.
Were you... Was that about...
She shrugs.
Who else?
Oh. I wish I'd recorded her set so I could replay the song over and over. For now, my memory has to fill in the space. A certain line comes to mind. What came before won't count anymore or matter. Can we try that?
Yes, I answer inside. Yes, 100,000 times.
7. This time we were at his house. Miguel would still have me over, but only when his mom was at work. I always liked his mom. Sharp tongue but soft heart. Amazing cook. Super welcoming. Until I got expelled. The sad twist that only Em and I could appreciate. My trying to help her son was what led her to hate me. Ever since that day at my house, our friendship had bloomed into something else. Junior year was hell, but Miguel was my silver lining. The one worthwhile part of my life. I always looked forward to seeing him, but lately that feeling was more like a compulsion. This gravitational force pulling me toward him. I didn't want to be near him. I had to. That day at his house, he lay next to me. I studied his body, trying to memorize it before it became hidden again. The way his skin seemed to absorb the energy of the lamplight. His chest caving in, forming a shallow pool. I wondered who else in his life was granted this privilege. Who else got to push that birthmark button? My social life resembled a line connecting only two points, but Miguel's was a circle. He had other friends at Hanover, a big family with lots of cousins, and there was an ex he still spoke to. Where did I fit in? Near his center? Or toward an outer ring? What is that? He asked, breaking the silence. I followed his gaze, realizing too late where he'd been looking. I'd forgotten that I'd removed my bracelets. Something I normally wouldn't do. Something his gravitational force persuaded me to do. I pulled my wrist away. Nothing, I said. He stared into my eyes. It felt like a challenge. I got out of bed, rolled my bracelets on. A few scars from a few idle nights. Passing time, really. A lighter, matches, candle wax. Fine, not nothing, but not totally something either. He sat up. You always do that, he said. Do what? I said, putting on my shirt. Anytime I get too close. His feet hit the floor. I tried to laugh. What are you talking about? We're always here at my house. You had me over one time. It's like you only give me these tiny glimpses. I challenged him with a dead stare. Why do you even care? It's not like...